BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. This is an extended version of the original Radio 4 broadcast, and for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the award-winning playwright and screenwriter James Graham. He's one of the most successful dramatists in Britain today, carving out a reputation for state-of-the-nation shows that offer profound insights into contemporary history. If that sounds a bit dry, it isn't. His skill at finding history's human heart and pinpointing its pivotal moments, with plenty of laughs along the way, has generated hit after hit. They include This House, about the minority Labour government of the 1970s, Ink, the story of Rupert Murdoch's takeover of The Sun, and Dear England, which spotlights how Gareth Southgate changed the culture of English football. His television work is equally impressive. He grew up in Nottinghamshire and in 2022 put his hometown on screen in the much-acclaimed BBC drama Sherwood, which addressed the deep divisions he saw in the wake of the miners' strike. It taught him to see both sides of a debate and to look for the humanity in those with whom he disagreed. He says, "People may think I'm too nice to be a political playwright and that I don't go for people's scalps. I try to empathise and understand them. I just think it's the easiest thing in the world to be cynical. It's lazy, it's unfair, it's really boring." James Graham, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure. Now, let's start with that empathy, James, because it isn't always prioritised in our polarised world. How do you ensure you can achieve it in your work?
By just asking the question, why is this person behaving the way they are? And I've put some pretty controversial and difficult people on stage and screen, whether that's Rupert Murdoch or Dominic Cummings. And I think there's just no point in reconfirming to an audience what they already think and feel. And the black and whiteness of storytelling has just never interested me. I think both people, but also our public institutions, whether it's newspapers or the radio or the Houses of Parliament, there are so many paradoxes and contradictions, and that's what makes drama so alive. And it's uniquely drama, I think, that has the space and the time to enjoy those contradictions and those paradoxes.
And you're also incredibly good at finding that those small things that can tell a really big story or unlock a kind of profound truth. I wonder how you do that. You're intrigued by looking for those moments, those events, those little stories that actually have a lot more to say.
I think it's probably my sort of nerdy, geeky interest in these worlds, and also my bewilderment, I guess, that I get invited into by simply writing a letter to the whips in the Houses of Parliament or the producers of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. It's the greatest joy to be invited into a process, a system, an institution where they will unpack it for you and make you understand in a Swiss watch kind of way how it ticks. You know, my recent play was about the England football team, and I got to go meet Gareth Southgate and his team, and that was a real, real joy. But my first questions are never about sort of the grand philosophical, what is it to win a tournament? I'm always like, where'd you get your lunch from? How'd you organise your office? What time did you come in? Did you park your car or did you come on it? Like, it is the minutiae and the detail that I actually think reveals a greater truth about these systems and these institutions that govern us in our public realm.
Tell me about your own experiences of theatre. I know it's a very special day for you, opening night, and the hours preceding the curtain going up. How does it feel? Talk me through a typical day.
My favourite moment is the hour before the first preview, when a new play, a new story that no one has ever seen before, is about to be put in front of an audience. And I always try to protect that time with my team, like the director and the designers. You go and have a quick bite to eat around the corner and you just take a moment. I normally have a little whiskey next to me and you try to be present in that moment, because you only share something for the first time once, which is an obvious thing to say. But from that moment on, in a couple of hours' time, it will always have existed and it will always be that thing. And that pre-going over the top moment with your team is really special.
It's time to get started with your music then, James. Disc number one, what are we going to hear?
Sure. Oh, God, I'm so insecure about my music choices. I think if you asked me what I'm most insecure about in the world, it would be talking about my personal life and my taste in music.
Okay, so this is going to be a tricky show.
I'm in existential crisis right here, but thankfully it's lovely.
Why? And why are you insecure about your music?
Honestly, if you shuffled my playlist, you're just as likely to get like the Emmerdale theme tune as you are the Ariana Grande latest chug. But we are where we are. And yeah, I thought this, I had to have Pulp in my list. There's something about that band and that music in the late 90s which kind of made sense for me. It sounded like what it was to grow up in a post-industrial town. The lyrics around small houses and wood chip on the wall and the fountain down the road. It really encapsulated the being with your mates and drinking and trying to look forward to the future. So I was going to pick Common People, one of my favourite songs, but my contemporary friend and writer Jack Thorne picked that, so I refuse because he's my nemesis. He's not. So instead I've picked what I think is just one of the most joyful pop tracks of the late 1990s, which is Disco 2000.
Pulp and Disco 2000. So, James Graham, you were born in Kirkby and Ashfield in Nottinghamshire. I know you're a twin. You've got a twin sister and a big brother. How much of your political awakening came from the time and place you were growing up?
We weren't a hugely political family, but I guess the town we grew up in was defined by the fact that it was a mining village. It's the community that I was so fortunate enough to put on television in Sherwood, because in the miner strike, a lot of the Nottinghamshire miners beneath us in the south, they went back to work. The majority of Yorkshire miners over the border, they stayed out of work. And so in these borderland villages where I grew up, they were sort of split. People in the same village were going back to work or staying out on strike. And that was obviously very painful. And it meant that was the scene of a lot of the violence in the 80s when the police came up to police the strike. And it took me a long time to understand the repercussions and the reverberations of that trauma. I think it taught me that ideological extremes or political certainties can be incredibly dangerous and can be incredibly wounding. I know enough brothers who will still cross the street from one another today, or friendships that were broken because of that inability. And I'm not judging them, but that inability to recognise how complicated and unfair the imposition of that choice was placed upon people.
Your parents, Anne and Peter, divorced when you and your twin sister were 6. Your bigger brother was 8. Can you remember how you felt about it at the time?
Well, actually, when my parents divorced, they did this incredibly generous thing at the time, which was they bought houses on the same street. So there were only 2 houses between us, so I could go and see my dad whenever me and my twin sister wanted to, and my brother could come and see my mum. So there was an attempt to keep us all sort of together as a family unit. But I loved my own company more than I loved hanging out with my brother or sister or my friends. I really liked being on my own in my room, and I began writing short stories from a really early age. My mum got me an electric typewriter, which I just adored.
How old were you when you got that?
Probably like 5 or 6. And I really, really valued that time in my own head to make sense of the world. But yeah, I was very relaxed growing up in terms of what the future held. It was actually the sort of the present day that made me frightened, like going to school and the people around me. I was really introverted and found socialising quite difficult.
So you lived with your sister, with your mum.
Mm.
What did she do for a living? Where did she work?
So my work ethic, I think, definitely comes from my mum. When I was growing up, she was a barmaid in most of the local pubs around the village, and including the working men's pub. But, I mean, my memory of her up until my teenage years was, at one point she had 3 jobs. She worked as a school receptionist in the day. In the evening, she would then go to the local warehouse. So when the mines closed, logistics and warehouses pretty much took over as the main employer in the area. And then at the weekend, she would work in the local corner shop, which was one of my first jobs as well. And my dad, he worked for Nottingham City Council. That was his first job when he was 18, and he stayed there all his life.
And how was it dividing your time between your parents?
I love them both individually, but my mum was sort of a raucous, extroverted character. Her family, full of sisters, that, you know, drink and parties and going out was a big part of that world. And I guess I would say that life with my dad was a bit softer and quieter. He was the only son. We would go train spotting, for example, and that was like sport, but quiet sport. And he introduced me to a lot of sort of classical music as well, which I really valued. And you know, I would sit quietly in his house with my headphones on, listening to like electronic 80s versions of opera and stuff, trying to get my head around. And I think there was something, again, about that kind of aspirational working class desire to introduce me and introduce us to culture and books and history and politics that I...
So they always really supported bad. Those interests.
Yeah, and still do. Like, I wish I could sit here going, my story was like a Billy Elliot story where I had to rail against them. They were going, don't be a playwright, get a proper job. That has just never been the case. And both of them are so sort of happy for me, and I'm so grateful for that.
All right, James, it's time for us to go to the music. What are we going to hear next?
Well, as an example of my father's sort of musical taste that was the soundtrack of my youth, I have picked Glenn Miller, which... I guess it felt like the men in my family always sort of had this kind of wartime vibe, like my granddad and my dad and my brother, planes and big band music and history, the history of war. So this featured a lot in our house. And I guess also Chattanooga Choo Choo, which is the track I've picked, is also about trains. And for some reason, trains have always just been huge in our family. My mum, she grew up in a train station with her sisters and brother. My granddad was the station master in a little train station in Eastwood in Nottinghamshire. And my dad would always take me and my brother on train journeys, train spotting. The problem was I had such a delicate constitution as a kid, I would always get travel sick. And he would have to carry these little bags around to capture that. And I remember this one time we had a little journey. I made it all the way up to Scotland on trains, all the way to Montrose, having not managed to throw up. And he was so proud of me. As we pulled into Montrose station, he gave me a little hug and a shake, and that made me throw up all over the table as we arrived into the station. So I think my delicate constitution extends to Glenn Miller. It's music, but it's soft and gentle and accessible.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga Juju?
Yes, yes, track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
Can you afford to board Chattanooga Choo-Choo?
I got my fare
and just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania station about a quarter to four. Read a magazine.
Chattanooga Choo-Choo, Glenn Miller and his orchestra. James Graham, as we've heard, you loved writing stories on your typewriter when you were a little boy. What else were you getting up to?
We were like a TV family. We used to love sitting in front of the TV every evening, dinner on our laps and watching dramas and soaps. I loved soaps growing up.
What did you love about them? What was the magic of it?
I guess if you're sort of a quieter, shy kid, there's something about the scale of the drama of everyday life, with people arguing in pubs or breaking up or plane crashes in Emmerdale or murders in Coronation Street. I guess just the escapism and the size of everyday life. And hobbies were like a big thing. I think in terms of we kind of imagined ourselves probably as like aspirational working class, like wanted to do things with our free time. And we were all given sort of instruments, or I ended up going ice skating, which was an unusual choice for a young boy in a tough mining town. But for some reason, gliding around on the ice, I got really excited about it. And actually, I wasn't sort of doing the flips and the spins. It was actually the show ice dancing, where you put on a costume and dance to a piece of pop music or musical theatre. It was that side of it that I really enjoyed. And it's not original, but I guess there was something about the permission that gives you to show off, to like, to make people laugh, to unleash yourself and wave your arms and be silly, that I think I really struggled with in normal life. And I remember doing loads of different parts. I dressed up as one of the girls in ABBA. And there was an absolute bizarre moment when I think it was my mum who came up with the concept, where she came up with this idea of the stripping vicar. I was only about 10 years old, but the routine we came up with was I came onto the ice wearing a little cassock and to really holy music, and I danced around the ice for like a minute. And then James Brown, I Feel Good, kicked in, and I whipped off my Velcroed cassock, and I had like stockings and Spanx and a corset on. And I would like writhe across the ice as like a 10-year-old boy, like spanking myself and wiggling my hips. And like parents were genuinely mortified and shocked. And I could always see my mum laughing and loving it. And we took that on tour, like around the country. People like, would see me turn up and they'd go, oh no, the stripping vicar's here, we've lost. Like I get all these plastic trophies for it. And I would never, like, I could never quite make sense of the little boy who really struggled to be in class or to be in school and around people. Who could do that?
And when you were at primary school, you got your first acting role in a production of Oliver. You were the lead.
I know, hey, I wasn't mucking about. But I was very aware that the reason why I got Oliver was because I was just this tiny, scruffy waif of a boy and I looked like an orphan and I couldn't sing and I really wanted to and they really wanted me to, but I just couldn't do it. So very sadly, I got the part. But every time a song came on in the production, a different lad had to come on stage and sing for me and I just had to go and sit on the side of the stage and watch him sing. And
oh,
obviously,
wow.
The audience obviously knew that was because I was terrible at singing.
Oh no, what did that do for your nascent creative expression?
Humbled me, and I actually felt more sorry for the other boy who probably should have been Oliver because he had this angelic voice. But yeah, look, I mean, what I really remember the most about stepping into the waters of school plays was the complete thrill for me of seeing a community of your neighbours come together in a space and share something, and the fact that you were part of that and that you were making your parents laugh as being by being a cute little orphan, or that you were telling a story. And shared storytelling just immediately imprinted itself in my brain as being one of the most valuable things we can do as a society.
It's time for your next piece of music. What have you got for us?
So as I got slightly older and moved to secondary school, I tried to find like my tribe and my gang. And somehow I slipped into the world of grungy band people, even though that was not sort of the music I felt comfortable with and sort of grew up with. But I just loved being in that group. And frankly, whenever, you know, in a mix of Rage Against the Machine and Metallica and Korn, whenever they would play a song that, you know, I could hum along to and had a nice little tune to it, I really valued that stuff and I would always request that stuff. So I picked Foo Fighters, who I did actually really love growing up. And this is probably the least cool Foo Fighters track. It's the love song he felt like he had to write. But whenever this came on, I was very, very happy because it was something I could sing along to myself. And this is Up in Arms.
Foo Fighters and Up in Arms. James Graham, as you've mentioned, you were a shy kid at school, but you were a very able student, and I think it was history that caught your imagination. Why?
I guess the storytelling of it. Like it's the purest example of week by week turning up to class and being told a story that you don't know how it's going to end. Like I really didn't. So we'd be doing the French Revolution and you get to the point where the guillotine's about to come down on Marie Antoinette and the bell would go and I literally wouldn't know, does she make it? And I think by default, my love of that, my love of returning to far away or recent history to make sense of the now has accidentally made me quite political. But it all came really from a love of storytelling.
So it started with the stories and your love of drama then continued at secondary school?
Yeah, so having absolutely smashed Oliver in primary school, I knew I really wanted to do more school plays, but again, struggled with my confidence. And it was the head of the drama department, Martin Humphrey, who was just one of those teachers who would go above and beyond and like stay late, work all weekend to allow us to help us put on plays and musicals and shows. And he just was determined to put me on stage. And I guess I thought maybe acting would be a thing. I didn't really know if writing would be a career. And again, whereas the rest of my life was sitting quietly at the back of the class, I remember the moments when I would get such bizarre confidence to be able to march on stage and play big roles like Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet and Robert Sideway in Our Country's Good, Tim Blake Wurtenbaker, who was the big sort of showy off eccentric actor character. And I'd see the lads in the football team kind of laughing in the audience and validating me. And I love that.
So what was going on in terms of your own identity and how you felt at that point and how you felt about who you were?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I knew I was very sensitive, and I was lucky that I had a lot of nice friends, but I'd still confuse myself about often when I was invited, like, to hang out on the street corner or to go up to the rec with my friends, I would sometimes pretend I wasn't feeling very well because the comfort of just being on my own just made me feel... people often talk about sort of authenticity, don't they, and being yourself. And I think that's so easy if you're a confident extrovert. It's actually, you have to work really hard on being yourself if you're not. But it wasn't like traumatic. I was sort of really at peace with the fact that I was just that kid. I was just that boy. And how lucky it was to have found in that particular community a form, an outlet in the form of theatre and art and drama.
You went on, James, to study drama at Hull University, and you have said since, Hull made me who I am. Why was it so special?
I'm sure part of it is because it was Hull, and I absolutely love that city. It's not that dissimilar from really the character of the place where we grew up in Nottinghamshire, which is, it doesn't take itself seriously. It's very no-nonsense, gallows humour, and the kind of culture and the kind of art, populist from a working-class tradition, from an industrial base, and... eventually I would start to write and put on plays in front of my colleagues and my peers as well. And again, the we'll get onto this, I think, but one of the great screenwriters in modern British history, Anthony Minghella, was there.
Yeah, well, tell me about that. So, and you met him?
I did, yeah. He'd just, I think, won his Oscar for English Patient, and we had about an hour together. And I think in education, the most valuable thing anyone can do is... personify the possibility of something. Like, normally you just don't, the world of art, entertainment, Hollywood film, it feels so removed and so distant, and meeting someone in the flesh who had done that from the buildings and the rooms that I was sat in was just so thrilling.
While you were at university, you wrote your first play, Coal Not Dole. It was about the miners' strike. What were you hoping to capture in the story?
I wanted to capture my community and almost go on an intellectual and creative exercise to see if I could replicate the voice of the people I grew up with by writing dialogue that sounds like what they would say. And wrote that, put it on, took it to Edinburgh. First time I sort of got reviewed, first time I left the newsagent holding a newspaper with my name in it and couldn't believe in it. And I think it was a 3-star review that everyone was really going, I'm so sorry, you're okay. And I was like, yeah, it's amazing, they're writing about me. I started to really get a sense of, God, this is what I want to do.
I think we better hear your next disc, James. It is your fourth choice today.
And this connects actually with Hull in the sense that the soundtracks to movies has been a love of my life for a long time. And I actually write often to the Hans Zimmers and the Max Richters of this world just because they're so emotive and they capture the sweeping scale of stories. And this particular track is from The Talented Mr. Ripley, which was an Anthony Minghella film. And this is by Gabriel Yared, who's a Lebanese-born composer. He did most of Anthony Minghella's music for his films. And this is from the end of the film, I think, where the main character, Tom Ripley, who's someone who hides himself away from the world, believes that he's going to be hidden forever.
Syncope from the soundtrack to The Talented Mr. Ripley, composed by Gabriel Yared. James Graham, after you graduated, you got a job as a stage doorkeeper at the Theatre Royal in Nottingham. What do you remember about that time?
I loved it. It was like a really tough job. I'd turn up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes you'd go through to 2 or 3 the next morning because you had to be the first person there and the last person to leave. And there was really special moments. I used to enjoy wandering around the building at midnight, the last person there, sitting on the stage of this Victorian theatre and just, like, I know it sounds really sappy, but they're imagining my plays on there one day, which did happen. And I remember the attrition in particular of seeing how hard people had to work, and none more so than Panto. Mm-hmm. Like, my Panto that year had the extraordinary Danny LaRue as the dame. He would come in and go, "Hello, James. Hello, darling." And he was just like from a different world. And he would never leave the building without shaking my hand and slipping a tenner in there as he left. I remember organising his Christmas dinner because he was staying in Nottingham at the time and he was on his own. And I organised his Marks and Spencer's chicken. And also what being on the stage door allowed me to do, once the show goes up at 7:30, basically you're on your own. And I would be writing my plays, the hum and the sounds and the noise of theatre behind me. I started writing full-length plays and putting them in little envelopes and sending them off to that London and hoping that someone would read them. And eventually one of them did.
You talked about being a shy, introverted child, but there must have been a part of you that said at that stage, "I'm good at this, I might be able to do this."
What I was really confident about and always committed to was that I was never going to write the kinds of other plays that younger writers were doing at that time. And I don't say that boastfully, like, "Oh, I'm so original." I say it as a lesson that I learned, which is that as I came down to London and became enmeshed in, like, the new writing scene down here, the expectation from a lot of the theatres that were for what a 20, 21-year-old should write about, and often it was understandably sort of relationships and sex and violence, and it came from the tradition of in-your-face theatre in the late 90s. And I mean, I one of my first plays was about the Suez Canal crisis, and like nobody was here for it, and nobody wanted it, and I just refused to kind of pivot because I just knew that was what really excited me. And I was so fortunate to find an advocate in the Finborough Theatre, which is like a tiny little theatre, 50 seaters above a pub in Earls Court, where you have to pretty much sort of paint and build your own sets. And I spent like 5 years there, like working in call centres and bars in the day, and then writing plays there in the evening about big sort of historic sweeps, Albert Einstein, Anthony Eden. I wrote a play about Margaret Thatcher.
I want to ask about one of your later plays, actually, Tory Boys. That was about Ted Heath's hidden sexuality. And I know that you wrote it during a time when you were exploring your own relationships, your identity. Did you learn anything about yourself while you were writing that play?
Yeah, I mean, my relationship history has been varied and flexible, and a bit like my growing up in North Nottinghamshire, which never sort of went down on one side or the other. I've always, up until recently, struggled a lot with sort of relationships and the level of, I guess, commitment and vulnerability and intimacy that a healthy one requires. And I don't think that's completely divorced from my professional life and my writing life and where I sit there. You know, I've had relationships with women and men, and I found a great comfort and peace in that, and not needing to define for anyone at any particular or given point mm-hmm. where I am or what I'm doing or how I'm, and being in a theatre community where it's less binary and you can not pin your colours to any particular mast, and it's progressive and tolerant. That's been a real value to me. And I've tried to, Tory Boys certainly was a way of putting on stage all the bizarre contradictions and nuances of the young experience, I think, when you're emerging politically and sexually and emotionally.
Let's go to the music. What's next?
This is the Queen, that is Kylie Minogue, and she was one of my first ever albums I remember getting on Christmas Day, and I've had a love affair with Kylie ever since. And actually this track I only discovered because Russell T Davies put it in a television drama, and Russell is the perfect example for me of someone who manages to smash into big, serious social studies or political State of the Nations. Just a huge amount of pop culture references, and particularly British pop culture references. And this was one of the first times I heard this banger of a track, which is "Your Disco Needs You."
Desperately seeking someone willing to travel. You're lost in conversation and useless at Scrabble.
Let's
Kylie Minogue and Your Disco Needs You. James Graham in 2012, your play This House premiered at the National Theatre and it was a huge breakthrough for you. Nominated for an Olivier Award, did you have any sense that it was going to be the kind of hit that it was? It changed everything for you.
I knew instinctively that the proposition on paper was really great and I can't take credit for that. That's just the real world delivered to me this story of this hung parliament. I found it a completely compelling and seductive world, and I hired an office in Soho because I thought that's what proper grown-up playwrights should probably do. And it was in this like garret in a loft above a sex clip show. I got to know the girls down there on the door quite well, and I would sit there trying to make sense of the 1970s and adored it. And so even though I knew it had potential, I didn't necessarily know if it was going to connect, because I think the conventional wisdom at the time was that there wasn't a huge appetite for plays about politics on stage.
I wonder what that's like for you. You know, when you're taking that personal view of recent history, do you get nervous about telling real people's stories?
I do, and I should do, because it's their story, and I really feel that responsibility. And I would worry if I stopped feeling that. And to be honest, it is the part of my job that I do sometimes find a bit overwhelming. It's the lying awake at 3 a.m. kind of anxiety when I worry about, I just don't want to ever upset people is the truth, but I do really believe in putting real stories on stage and screen as a way of making sense of them. And sometimes these are quite public figures, whether, you know, the coughing major in Quiz or someone like that. What a great treat to go and spend time with the producer if he wants to be a millionaire, or the victims of that scandal. But I do take that really seriously about real people. And I think the only thing I can sort of say is my tactic is you have to go in and go early and go hard and be really honest about that you're doing it and allow them to express their anxieties and their doubts and their concerns. It's my duty to sit in those living rooms and listen to that and then adapt my work to make sure that I'm telling the truth of their experience, but that they feel okay on the journey of it.
So what is it like, James, when you actually meet someone who you've just put on stage in theatrical form? And what's the conversation like?
Well, obviously you feel like hugely presumptuous. They've come to see your play, you've just presented them on stage, and then you're speaking to them afterwards in the bar. And it can be a great thrill, because obviously they've just seen themselves as represented by an actor, and they're sort of in the thrill of that. But obviously sometimes it can be quite intense and awkward. So I've met politicians who were in this house after that, in the play Ink, which was about Rupert Murdoch taking over the Sun newspaper in the late 60s. He did come and see it, I remember, and I met him in the West End Theatre afterwards. I remember being very intimidated and scared in the build-up to that meeting. In the end, as often happens, it's actually quite vanilla. Like, you hope to come away with like a really good dinner party anecdote. He said this to me, and actually, I think he was a particularly studied case in not giving anything away. He met the actors, asked some questions about my research, and then left. So it's not always the key moment, actually, that you would expect it to be.
And I love that you're willing to take it on even when, and maybe because it's difficult. You know, with something like Sherwood, this is based on two real-life murders that happened in your hometown, near your hometown, 20 years ago, went out on BBC One. And even though you knew that the community around you would have their own feelings about it, you very much felt like you were the right person to do it, the only person to do it.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, the tragedies that the drama depicts happened only like a couple of streets away from where I grew up, and I knew a lot of the individuals involved. And I hope I didn't impose the project upon the people. I did go up and chat to the victims and people in the community to see if they were okay with it. And it was a mix. Like, some people said, I think it's time that we talked about this, not just the killings themselves, but also the wounds that reopened up, essentially these killings, even though they had nothing at all to do with the divisions of the miners' strike, them happening reopened them, and it was very painful. And some people believed it was time, and some people really didn't. They thought, you know, the phrase I heard sometimes was, can't you let sleeping dogs lie? And you have to hear that, but stay true to the principle that guides me always, which is that ultimately at the end, once it's out and once people are seeing it, that we all will as a community value the opportunity to cathartically walk through that stuff again, through hopefully an empathetic, gentle, kind way. But I don't pretend to know the rules of it, and it is very difficult, but I just know the principle is sound, and that we have to look at these difficult stories and we have to put them on stage and screen.
It's time to go to the music, James. What's next?
My love affair with David Bowie knows no bounds, and it sounds like Britain when he talks about market squares and dance halls and workers going on strike, and yet somehow there's a fantastical otherness to his galactic characters and the wonder and the fantasy and the magic he gave to mundane post-war British life, and I guess also decades before sexual fluidity and everything else became cool. He spoke openly about his own ambiguity, and as I've wandered through that journey myself, someone who constantly reinvents themselves and defies definition in such a humane and exciting and electric way is everything I want in an artist. And I really struggled to pick one. Like, 5 years was in this house, Under Pressure was in Labour of Love in the West End, but I wanted to go more towards the end of his life, and this song to me expresses the gift that I think he left us with. This was recorded just a couple of years before he died, and this is Where Are We Now?
As long as there's sun, as long as there's sun, as long as there's rain, as long as there's rain, as long as there's
David Bowie and Where Are We Now? James Graham, the word prolific really doesn't do justice to your output. There was a point where it seemed like you were writing a play and TV script every single year. And in 2017, you actually had two plays, Ink and Labour of Love, in the West End, in theatres 100 metres apart at the same time. What did that feel like?
That was a... you spend a lot of time in subsidised theatres or regional theatres, and but you can't pretend there isn't like a real glamour and excitement to being in with all those lights in the centre of London. And it was also obviously very, very convenient. I could walk between rehearsals and get a coffee on the way. And yeah, it was nice.
I love the fact that the distance allowed you to do more works, because this is very you.
Yes.
I mean, the term workaholic is thrown around quite a lot, but I think you've had an actual diagnosis, haven't you?
Yes, I knew that I knew something wasn't quite right in sort of my late 20s.
What happened?
I would go into periods where I would be far too isolated from friends or self-sabotage relationships as soon as they became intimate and important, and was just working like around the clock continually, but without really looking after myself. So I went to just start to speak to people about it. But I actually went to see a particular woman who probably saved me. And the first thing she said to me, was she was listening to me wanging on about feelings, and she eventually just said, "Why aren't you wearing a coat?" And I think it was winter, it was really cold outside, and I had like a really flimsy paper thing on, basically, right from the summer. And I just hadn't had time at that point to go out and buy a winter coat. And so I brushed it aside, but she was like obsessing about it, going, "Why, like, you're starting to do okay, like, why can't you go and take an hour to buy a nice coat?" And I was getting really frustrated with it, like, that's not the issue here, it's not my... And that was obviously to her symptomatic of an inability to sometimes to look, sort of look after myself. So I took that on the chin, and she said, go to this particular group, which was Workaholics Anonymous. And like you, I mentioned, you hear that phrase a lot, like it's a...
It's just a thing people say.
Yeah, it's a habit that you have. It's not an actual sickness, but it is. And I didn't realise that at the time. And then you go into a meeting and you sit down and everyone begins to talk about their behaviours, and you go, "Oh my God, yeah, I do that. Mm. And actually understanding that it is an illness, and it is addiction in no way different really from drink or drugs or sex or anything else. It's a pattern of behaviour that is slowly sort of killing you, and people spoke of the people they lost due to it. I think the moment I realised I had a problem was I'd started to lie to my family and my friends about stupid things that didn't even need lying about. Like, they would go, "You look tired, what time did you get up today to work?" And I would say, "Oh, you know, 8. And I'd say to myself, "But I know I got up at 5. That's really weird. Why did I say that?" Or I wouldn't have eaten for a whole day. And I think that's when I knew it was an actual problem. And then irising out from that, realising that that also fed into my issues around relationships and intimacy, because I was, all of my self-esteem, all of my validation, all of my happiness and joy was coming from work, and I didn't allow myself to believe that there was space for anything else.
It's complicated as well, because you obviously love your work.
I know, that's why it's really hard. So the dilemma I've always had, and the dilemma I'm still in sitting here today, is that I know I have an unhealthy relationship with it and that my balance is way off, but it gives me such joy. It gives me such value and happiness to get up in the morning and write, or to be in a rehearsal room with a company of actors, or to go on set. And I don't know how to split the two. I don't know how to... Well, I do. It must be possible to balance your work and your love with other things. And I'm aware of it. I have amazing friends and family who I've sort of come out to and said, I have this problem, and who check in on me and check that I'm okay. I don't know if I'll ever get it completely right. And this will sound really stupid, but even like you mentioned, the two plays on at the same time, like 90% of me was just like really happy and proud of that. There was like 10% of me that going, that's part of your, you know, you look up at the lights and go, that's part of your illness, isn't it? Like, that's ridiculous, James. Nobody needs
two plays. Manifestation,
yeah.
Too many.
And everyone's going, that's so amazing, which actually then feeds into your cycle of self-validation, and you go, well, why don't I have three plays on at the same time? Why don't I have four? And you just have to, yeah. So I'm aware of it, and it's, yeah. But it's tough because, God, I'm so lucky and I just love it so much.
Work in progress, then.
Indeed.
Let's have some more music, James. It's your seventh choice today. What is it?
I got to write a musical recently with Elton John, who you may have heard of.
I mean, familiar with. Yeah, and Jake Shears.
And Jake Shears, who did the lyrics, Elton did the music, and I wrote the script, the book. And this was called Tammy Faye, and we opened it at the Almeida Theatre in London, set in the world of televangelism in the 1980s, and this extraordinary woman, Tammy Faye Baker, who came from that world of the Christian evangelical right, and yet she was this huge empath who basically welcomed in at the time the gay community into her television shows, and she invited famously a pastor who had been diagnosed HIV positive. She invited him onto the show at a time when that was a complete no-no. So she pushed up against the prejudices of the church because her faith was about love and acceptance and tolerance. And so even though this hasn't been released yet, because we're building up to our Broadway show later this year, this is sung by the extraordinary Katie Braben, who played Tammy Faye. She won an Olivier for this role. And this is called If You Came to See Me Cry.
If you came to see me cry, you might as well grow wings to fly. I could fall from heaven's high, but the pain won't cloud my eyes. I'd do it all again. I did my best up to the end. Maybe you should wonder why.
If You Came to See Me Cry, from Tammy Faye, the musical, composed by Sir Elton John, with lyrics by Jake Shears, performed by Katie Braben. And best of luck with taking that to Broadway,
thank
James
you.
Graham. So the Tammy Faye show and many others of yours, I mean, Quiz, for example, interestingly, they do all seem to examine these questions around the contemporary morality. What does it mean to be good, to do the right thing?
Mm.
Are those questions that you spend a lot of time with yourself, your own personal life?
I'm not imagining, I hope, a brilliant, glorious past when everyone behaved decently with one another. But I do think we're living through an incredibly dangerous and troubled time, in the sense that there is new currency to division and short-term division, or long-term division for short-term gain in our politics. And you can feel some of that being embedded into the fabric of sort of the institutions that I love to put an examine on stage and screen.
And are you an optimist? Are you hopeful today?
Totally, yeah. I can't actually think sort of when I last wrote a story that sort of had an unhappy ending. And I don't think that's imposing artificial optimism onto stories that don't naturally have them. But I think a bit like Dear David Bowie, who infused his own work with such hope and belief in people and their innate goodness, that, yeah, I can't let go of that for my own characters, even in sort of difficult and troubled times.
Where do you go when you need to up your reserves of hope and optimism?
The theatre. I find it incredible still that we, in the age of Netflix and everything else, that we still do this quite bizarre thing. I always think of aliens visited the planet the theatre with the thing that would most confuse them. Like, why do you... So what, you all go into a dark room and pretend that something is real when you know it's not? For what value? And we do it. And I find every play has an innate sort of hope to it, even if it's a really traumatic story or a really difficult, upsetting tale of injustice, of which God knows there are many. The act of gathering around it and telling it gives me hope, because if we can do that, then maybe we can find solutions.
I'm going to be casting you away to a completely new scene. You'll have to create a new world on the desert island.
Yeah.
How do you feel about life as a castaway?
Okay with it. Like, honestly, I could do with the rest. I could do with the sleep. And
how will you be with the rest, though? Be honest, James.
I'll take a morning off. Once I've crash landed, I'll take a morning off and then I'll start working on some stuff. But no, I mean, yeah. And I guess also the joy of the desert island is always the possibility that you're going to be saved the next day or the day after or the day after. And I'm sure that will keep me going.
You've got to stay hopeful.
Yeah.
Well, we'd love to hear one last track from you before you go. Your final choice today, what's it going to be?
I spend a lot of time thinking about political songs and protest songs from Bob Dylan onwards. And I guess this one in particular, this is by Rufus Wainwright. I really value it because even though it is politically charged, it was written about America during the time of the War on Terror, it still somehow yet manages to be a popular, soaring, theatrical, arty, moving, melodically satisfying, soft song. And actually, I bumped into Rufus in a theatre. This sounds so pretentious, but yeah, bumped into Rufus at an opening night recently. I was too scared to say anything to him. I stood next to him at the bar. The only gift I gave him was that they were about to close the bar, and after I got my drink, I indicated that he should be served. So I gave him a glass of champagne, but I was too scared to say, I'm going to put you on Desert Island Discs. But he's here anyway, and this is Going to a Town.
I'm going to a town that has already been burnt down. I'm going to a place that has already been disgraced. I'm going to see some folks who have already been let down. I'm so tired of America.
Rufus Wainwright and Going to a Town. So, James Graham, I'm going to send you away to the island now. I'll give you the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and you can take one other book, whatever you fancy, with you. What will it be?
I've really wrestled, but actually I've just gone with A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking. Never read it, and this would be a good opportunity to bank that in my brain. It's something about time passing, which I've always had a bit of an anxiety about getting older, and there's something about not thinking of the time on the island as being wasted, because time is relative, as Hawking told us. And I think keeping that in my head would be good for my mental health, and knowing that, yeah, that the time on the island essentially is not a waste of time, it's meant to be.
Oh, it's going to be the perfect book for you. It's yours. You can also have a luxury item. What would you like?
I would love to have like a keg of whiskey, if that's right. Like a single malt Scottish whiskey.
Well, and whiskey for you is a creative inspiration. I mean, you've written a play about whiskey.
I've written a play about whiskey, which meant I had to do, unfortunately, a lot of research, which was tax deductible. But yes, like a keg of whiskey is actually a living, breathing thing. It ages and evolves every year, and it's alive. It's like basically having a pet, but that I can drink. And I think knowing that every single year the whiskey will be tasting different and will be maturing and developing characteristics, that means that, again, it will help me pass the time knowing that the whiskey's growing while I'm growing.
Finally, which one track of the eight that you've shared with us today, James, would you rush to save from the waves if you needed to?
I'm definitely going to need David Bowie with me on the island. And there is something about that particular track. I love the lyrics at the end. Essentially, he sings, as long as there's sun, as long as there's rain, as long as there's fire, as long as there's me, as long as there's you. And I just love that about him. And I think his parting gift to all of us as Bowie fans was that sense of hope and optimism about the human spirit.
This island sounds like it's going to be great.
Thanks. Come along.
James Graham, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thanks so much.
Hi.
Hello, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with James, and I hope he savours every mouthful of his whiskey. We've cast away many screenwriters and playwrights, including David Hare, Tom Stoppard and Kay Mellor. James's friend Jack Thorne is in our archive too. You can find these episodes in our Desert Island Discs programme archive and through BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Duncan Hannans. The assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producer was Paula McGinley. The series editor is John Gowdy. Next time, my guest will be Jenny Seeley, the artistic director of Grey Eye Theatre Company. I do hope you'll join us.
Hello, Russell Kane here. I used to love British history, be proud of it. Henry VIII, Queen Victoria, massive fan of stand-up comedians, obviously Bill Hicks, Richard Pryor. That has become much more challenging, for I am the host of BBC Radio 4's Evil Genius, the show where we take heroes and villains from history and try to work out, were they evil or genius? Do not catch up on BBC Sounds by searching Evil Genius if you don't want to see your heroes destroyed. But if, like me, you quite enjoy it, have a little search. Listen to Evil Genius with me, Russell Kane. Go to BBC Sounds and have your world destroyed.